Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the writer and comedian Tim Minchin. Add to the list composer, actor and musician, and you'll just about have the measure of him. He's had sell-out performances at London's O2, written the songs for the smash hit West End show Matilda, and collected an armful of awards along the way. And all before he's hit 40, it would be easy to hate him, if it weren't for the acute satirical insight of his lyrics and the virtuosity of his musicianship. Another of his talents is undercutting all the success and acclaim, with lines like, "I thought fame would make me happy, but she's a fickle, cheap romance." What does make you happy, Tim Minchin, I wonder?
Oh, that's a tough start. coffee, red wine, sleep, a limited amount of time with my own children. talking about myself, you know, just the normal stuff.
We should have quite a good time then. Do you think writing for children, as you very successfully have with Matilda, do you think you understand children? Was it easy to work out what would be appealing to that six-year-old audience?
I didn't feel a real connection to my childhood self, although I did have a young baby and another one on the way when I wrote Matilda, and I think without that I would have really struggled because it just opened that door back a little bit and sort of reminded me how innocent innocence is, you know. I'm not a magical thinker. I don't think I need my special undies on or my special pencil. I'm the opposite of Roald Dahl in so many ways, but I'm not superstitious about the process. So I've always gone, I just need a quiet room. I just took my childhood of reading Dahl and went, I know what this is, and wrote some songs.
So the production has just won an extraordinary, 7, I think, Olivier Awards, including for Best New Musical. It's also been named Best Musical by the Evening Standard Awards, the London Theatre Awards and the Critics' Circle Awards. Is due to transfer to Broadway next year. Astonished? Not astonished? Slightly surprised when all those started rolling in?
I don't suppose when the awards started coming in I was surprised anymore because I'd seen what it did to people. I watch audiences come out with this look of glazed happiness on their faces, and I thought, this is working.
Can you explain that to me, that experience of did you sort of stand right at the back of the theatre and watch the audience? Are you sitting among them? Are you backstage?
I guess I get my impression from the audience of listening to the reactions. I always just sit right in the guts of it because I want to hear. I'm most obsessed by the sound, so I want to hear how the sound is sounding. You can tell in the theatre, that's the wonderful thing about theatre, you always, and comedy, you know exactly what's going on, whether they're interested or not. And the laughter, always the laughter being the measure of whether or not your comic bits are succeeding. And it is, I surely don't need to say, something that I am just one contributor. It's not magical because of what I did, it's magical because of what the team did together, sort of thing.
Time to turn Tim Minchin to your choices for this morning. Tell us about...
No.
Yes. You've had difficulty with the choices, haven't you? It's been a...
I love that I got asked to do this because it's such an honour. And you think, oh, this would be great. I get to trawl through the music I've loved. And I have just hated it. So, I love blues and stuff. I grew up listening to my uncle Jim, who's a bluegrass/blues musician, playing in pubs in Fremantle. So I was trying to choose one, and of course what happens when you're trying to choose, you sort of feel like you need to pay homage to the history of it. So I went all the way back to Muddy Waters, and I went with Mojo Working because it's an absolute classic.
Got my mojo working, but just gonna work on you. Got my mojo working, but just gonna work on you. I wanna love you so bad till I don't know what to do. I'm gonna down and lose and get me a mojo.
Muddy Waters and Mojo Working. You've said, Tim Minchin, I passionately believe in not setting goals. You don't get opportunities if you think you know what you're meant to be doing. Tell me more about that then. You've just sort of randomly embarked on that. You did say that. Do you want to change your mind?
No, I believe that very strongly, but it's significantly influenced by hindsight because it's worked for me. I'm incredibly squeamish about this sort of, I've always wanted this, this is my dream to be X, you know, I'm going to pursue my dream come what may and all that sort of stuff. I hate that sort of non-specific language, it doesn't mean anything, you know, to me. I don't get what you're saying, you have a dream and it seems to not be influenced by any other factors but your fantasy of it. Probably more of us have the sort of life where happily lots of opportunities come your way and you need to be ready to receive them by having your eyes not on the prize but on everything around you. And I guess if I had to impart wisdom to my children, which I hope never to do to them, I would just say work incredibly hard at whatever you're doing and then people will respect you and you then they'll ask you to do something else, you know. It sounds... I'm actually a terrible procrastinator and my mum and I shouted at each other for 10 years about me not doing my homework. I'm not disciplined at all, but if I've got a task in front of me, I go pretty hard at it and I think that works.
You have two kids, 1 5, 1 3 this year, I think. And what about you with your kids then? Are you a terribly free and easy parent? You just let them kind of do what they want to do?
Well, I guess they're not old enough to have challenged our sort of belief in what parenting is or anything. I don't know what I'm going to be like. I imagine, because it's how I was brought up and it worked for me and I really appreciate it, I will be demanding of my children that they do their best at anything they do, that old boring stuff. But I'm certainly not... I don't have them in music classes or anything.
Right.
I'm not interested in trying to see how close I can get them to being prodigies. I don't believe that early uptake of skills correlates with eventual happiness. You know, this sort of, well, my kid can spell and she's 4 and my child goes to 7 lessons and it's like, what, why? They might enjoy that if you leave them alone, you know.
Let's have some more music, Tim. Our second disc, what is it?
Well, I'm a huge Kinks fan. People ask me where I get my interest in musical comedy from and, you know, did I listen to Victor Borg or Tom Lehrer or, you know, Weird Al Yankovic, and I always say no, but I love the bands who use lyrics to satirical purpose, which happened and happens a lot. And of course, Ray Davis was writing Dedicated Follower of Fashion and I'm an Ape Man and stuff at the same time as he was writing some of the most beautiful songs ever made. I love him as a lyricist. I love his voice. So I went with my heart and went with probably one of my favourite songs ever written, which is Waterloo Sunset.
Dirty old river, must you keep rolling, flowing into the night? People so busy, make me feel dizzy, taxi light shines so bright. But I don't need no friend.
That was the Kinks and Waterloo Sunset. So Tim Minchin, you live in London now, but you grew up in Perth in Western Australia. What can you tell us?
Well, I was in Perth till I was 26, and my childhood is a childhood of school and beach and hockey, basically. We were a hockey family, and my sister played for the state, and my dad played, and my brother and I played hockey 5 times a week.
And your dad is a surgeon?
Is, yep.
What was his specialism?
He trained as a general surgeon, which I guess was defined by someone who has a knife and doesn't do hearts or above the neck sort of thing.
Okay, so did they expect stuff of you? Did they expect stuff of all their children in terms of academic achievement?
It's weird, isn't it? You feel like your parents are really heavy when you're young, but I look back and realise how, in my opinion, how right they got it, where they put their emphasis. I went to a boys' private school for 11 years, and private schools in Australia aren't like the public schools here, but they're still... You know, I was privileged to go to that school. But we didn't have fancy cars and we went camping and my granddad had a farm and we spent our weekends on the farm. And they didn't ever say we had to be doctors and they didn't say we had to be professionals, and none of us are, in the sense that we're not lawyers, doctors, vets and dentists. So there was low amount of pressure in that regard, but a reasonable amount of pressure in terms of not letting yourself down. And if we came home 5 minutes late, our mum would be pacing the floor and she was not at peace with risk, my mum.
Didn't she also tell you to shut the door when you were practising piano so she wouldn't disturb the rest of the house?
And well, she might. I sort of taught myself piano on a pianola, pedal piano, that belonged to my great-grandmother, and it was an awful piano, and I was an awful player of it. So it would have been... And apart from her boiling frustration, the fact that I wasn't in my room doing the essay she knew was due tomorrow. So she would always, just shut the door! And then they sort of did an extension that allowed there to be two doors between the piano and the kitchen, so she was happier then.
White Wine in the Sun is one of your best-known recordings. It talks about the relationship between you and your family, and it seems in the song, at least, in the words of the song, that it was motivated by looking at your first child and thinking, the circle has closed, I get it now.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what your parents made of the song when they heard it.
I think they really like it. We're not a particularly demonstrative family. We're a hyper-communicative family. We all talk to each other every week, but we're not emotionally demonstrative, and that's a pretty emotionally demonstrative song. They love it. It's very personal, but that song wasn't an epiphany for me. I had my baby and I was in London, and I was overwhelmed by a sense that I needed to get it home, stick it in the ocean and show it to my mum. And that didn't come as a surprise to me, because you could have asked me 5 years before I had a baby and I would have said I love my family and I like going home and seeing them, you know.
Let's have some more music, Tim Minchin. The third track of the day is what?
Oh, aren't you clever the way you've lined that up?
Do you see that?
Incredible.
You think this just happens by accident?
Yeah,
<don't>
So this song is called Feel Like Going Home, and I only know any music because of my brother. In fact, many, many songs that I love, I didn't even hear the originals. He just played them to me, and I was like, that's awesome. And he'd be like, yeah, these are the chords, and we'd play it. And some years later, I'd hear the song for the first time. And this song was written by Charlie Rich, and it's a religious song, as far as I know. In the version we're going to play, it's got a slide guitar in it, which it's not my style. But when he's just playing and singing by himself, it's absolutely incredible. And it has that feeling of, look, I'm tired. I just need someone to look after me now, and if it's Jesus for Charlie Rich, then all well and good for me. I guess it's my family.
Lord, I feel like going home. I tried and I failed, and I'm tired.
That was Charlie Rich and Feel Like Going Home. So, Tim Minchin, your big brother was sort of your musical mentor, really. He could play piano, could
he? He played guitar, and we were in bands together from when I was 15 or 14 or something. We played music together often in a sort of rather Brady Bunchy way, standing around the pianola singing piano roles.
With your mum and dad?
With everyone, and harmonies and stuff. But my brother and I always played music, you know, Beatles Bumper Songbook and all that sort of stuff. And Katie, the kid after me, Katie's a great singer. And my baby sister, who's quite a lot younger, I sort of discovered a few years ago that she sort of writes songs, and a lot of them quite satirical. She's got a much better musical ear than I have, but she doesn't have the temperament to face the slings and arrows of the music industry.
What kind of temperament do you need to survive?
I think you need the temperament that drives people like me, which is probably a slightly uncool thing, which is the need to be affirmed and show off and stuff.
What about your look? I'm sure you do wash your hair, but you deliberately make it look like you don't wash your hair.
I don't wash it very often.
No, okay, how often?
We can go through maybe fortnightly.
Okay, not very often. Yeah. And you're not wearing eye makeup today, but on stage you have some wonderful sort of sparkly with the liner on the inside of the eye.
Yeah.
And there's quite a lot of work that's gone into the eye makeup. Is that to evoke the sense that, you know, you're a bit edgy and rock and rolly and just be careful?
There's something in the tension of the fact that I look like I want to be a rock star, but I play a grand piano, and yet neither of them fit at all with the fact that I'm talking about cognitive dissonance and fallacies of logic. I'm more comfortable the less genre-able I am. And what I do is not hard to explain. I'm a cabaret artist, you know. I just happen to talk about ideas. So I do a 5-minute bit in the middle of my show at the moment with a copy of the Quran on stage talking about the sacredness of objects. I also do lots of material not about big ideas. I have a 7-minute song about cheese, and it's not rocket science, but it does allow me to be slightly difficult to categorise in terms of comparisons, and that's a really wonderful thing.
We're going to have some more music. Our next disc is what, Tim?
I almost didn't put Ben Folds on the list because people compare piano rock players to other piano rock players because there's not so many of them. So anyway, I was going to avoid him so people didn't draw more comparisons than were there, but the fact is he is one of the greatest songwriters. There's something that just feels so individual about him, like he's just expressing exactly who he is. It's called One Angry Dwarf and 200 Solemn Faces. It's just a cracking song.
Was Ben Folds and One Angry Dwarf and 200 Solemn Faces. So, Tim Minchin, your breakthrough in this country, at least, came at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It was 2005. By that time, you'd been working for about a decade on your music and your stand-up, and yet you were named Best Newcomer. Was there something a little bit galling about that?
No, not really, because I'd actually only been... it was my first ever attempt at doing comedy, that show. I wasn't new to the stage, and I wasn't new to playing music. But my 20s were spent sometimes composing for theatre, sometimes playing in cover bands, a hell of a lot of cover bands, piano bars, acting when I got acting work, and I'd had a great time. And then early 2005, I straightened my hair and put the eyeliner on, and by Melbourne Comedy Festival 2005, I kind of had what you would call a comedy show. And so I was new, you know, I was really new.
To go and do your comedy at the Edinburgh Fringe, that's quite a brave thing to do. I mean, that's where, you know, a lot of comedians live and die by their Edinburgh reviews.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really know that. I didn't know anything about the reviewers. I didn't know any of the other comedians. I'd never heard of Bill Bailey or, you know, I wasn't a comedy watcher. I'd never seen a stand-up show in my life.
You got a very bad review at Edinburgh, which has since become infamous because it was by a man called Phil Doust. I don't know how many people read the review at the time, probably really not that many, but a lot of people know about it now because you wrote a song in response to his bad review. The song's called Song for Phil Doust. Brave, dramatic, and probably wonderfully petty that you did that.
So petty. Well, I don't know how I feel about the song anymore because I feel bad for Phil that... if you type his name in or whatever, his name is associated with my song.
Have you spoken to him personally?
No, I haven't, but a journalist followed him up and said, have you ever heard this song? And he said, I hated his act when I first saw it. Why would I listen to another 5 minutes? So, but of course, it then goes on the internet and 4 or 5 years later, it's still there. And that's the bit I don't feel great about because I'm beyond that period of my life. And I think it's... a real pity that both his review of me and my review of him are still out there. But I actually didn't write that song straight off the back of it. It really affected me, and that's more because I was not ready for an article in a national English newspaper. That was just so awful. And that's a hard lesson to learn. I think all reviewers should write as if they're watching a friend of their sister's.
I shall play the part of reviewer here and say, well, you know, do you know what, to mention you're charging tickets and you need to entertain me. If I'm not entertained, then I have the right to spread the word that you're not an entertaining performer.
Yeah, but you're wrong. Because the arts are subjective and there are great reviewers out there who would make that argument and I would understand them because they know how to write about something that they don't think is achieving its goals. People are quite contemptuous of artists who are not good at dealing with reviews, but I think it's completely disingenuous because it hurts being told that what you've worked on is useless. And I'm probably particularly not good at it, which is why I don't read them anymore. Imagine you had to get up, you the listener, dear listener, had to get up every night and do a whole lot of jokes that you already know you don't find funny anymore. write a whole lot of songs that you don't like the tunes of anymore because you wrote them yourself. Sing with a voice that you loathe because it's your own voice. These are all normal human things, right? To not like your own material. And then someone in a national newspaper, your newspaper, the one you respect and read, makes specific criticisms of specific bits in the show and doesn't say this could do with work, but says this makes this person not deserve to be on stage. How would you feel at the point you get to that point in your show that night? How do you get up on stage and get to that joke again with that guy's words ringing in your head? The answer is toughen the hell up. It's not the worst thing that ever happened. You're not mining coal as a 7-year-old. And that's the answer I took back onto stage. It wasn't the worst thing in the world, but it is very, very hard to recover from when you're new to it.
You say you don't read reviews? You didn't read the reviews for Matilda then?
Oh, I read the reviews for Matilda because they're not about me. They're about something I've created with a group of people. The trouble with comedy is it's all you.
Why continue to put yourself out there? Because it would be, if you feel it as deeply as you've just described it,
yeah.
You know, the sense
sounds
that
a bit much, doesn't it? I'm sorry.
I'm not quite as uncool
as all that.
But it's interesting that you still seem to need and want to go out there and put yourself out there to be judged.
Yeah, because while I don't like my voice and doubt my work, there's another part of my brain that knows that I'm good at it. I'm probably really good at it, you know. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I mean, I could not design my career to be better than it is. I get to play music. I get taken seriously. I make people cry in my shows. I make them laugh. I play my own material. I play pianos that are better than I deserve with musicians that are better than I am in rooms that I wouldn't have dreamt of. And then I get to write musical if I want as well. It's ridiculous. Why would you stop?
We'll have some music, Tim. What are we going to hear?
Well, I reckon I sang this song standing in my parents' lounge room to the vinyl, original London cast recording version of JC Superstar maybe 500 times, and subsequently got to understudy the role of Judas in 2 separate Perth productions of JC Superstar, but never played the role. And I keep thinking, one day I'm going to play Judas, but I just love it because it's just pain and rock. And this is Heaven on Their Minds, which is the first thing that anyone sings.
I remember when this whole thing began. No talk of God, then we called you a man. And believe me, my admiration for you hasn't died. But every word you say today gets twisted round some other way. And they'll hurt you if they think you've lied.
That was Carl Anderson and Heaven on Their Minds from the soundtrack to Jesus Christ Superstar. A lot of your fans, Tim Minchin, might be surprised that you've chosen a track from Jesus Christ Superstar. And also we heard earlier on the Charlie Rich almost spiritual song. You're not moving over from devout atheism to some other place, are you?
You can't be a devout atheist.
Well, I was trying to be a
rock. People who are religious always think people like us are kind of just on our own journey to find Jesus. But as you can tell from my material, I'm intrigued by belief and by religion. There are times when people's quirky magical beliefs anger me when they end up being used to pass laws that are bad for the rights of the individual. I only care about people's religious belief where it hurts other people in terms of my comedy. In a broader sense, I'm just really interested in it.
You went on a tour of the Southern States of America last year.
Sort
of, you know, the home of the very sort of right-wing fundamental wing of the church. How did you get on there?
It's incredible, actually, in America. I'm not touring my show around trying to convert people away from their faith, but America's got 350 million people in it. Even if only 1 in 10 of them are not religious, I've got 35 or 50 million people who might not hate my material. And they come. I've flown up from Kentucky and they're crying, you know, we're school teachers and our family don't talk to us anymore. And, you know, they're there to hear me say, not only is it okay not to believe what all your mates think, but you should be cross when they step on your toes, you know. And I don't only say that, and people come to my shows in the UK for all different reasons, but in America they seem to be those people.
Let's have some more music then, Tim Minchin. We're on your 6th choice.
Well, there are so many great Deep Purple songs, but this song is just ridiculously cool. It's from the era where Ritchie Blackmore was playing guitar and Ian Gillan was singing. And
I just love it. It just rocks. It's ridiculous. It's called I'm Alone.
That was Deep Purple and I'm Alone. So, Tim, is it true that when the RSC asked you to get involved in Matilda, your wife Sarah said, why don't they ask someone proper to do it?
Yeah, of course. But it's true. It's absolutely true. Sarah's question was my question. That's the thing with being with someone for 20 years. She just asked me what I was asking myself, which is why they didn't get someone proper to do it.
And you met Sarah, did you meet her when you were at school?
Yeah, I vaguely remember her from the school lawn, but it was really first year uni and we turned up at arts degree and we were doing a lot of the same courses, so we started hanging out.
You wrote her the song, If I Didn't Have You, Someone Else Would Surely Do.
Mm-hmm.
What does she make of that?
She didn't like it initially. I don't know what's wrong with her. Humorless cow. The song is about statistical probability and the unlikelihood that of soulmates.
Yeah, you fall within a bell curve, I think, is one of the lines.
She falls within a bell curve, and that she might be right out the edge in terms of outstanding humans. Who's to say? But she might be out the other edge. But I was trying to write a song, a funny song, about how love is more valuable when you've chosen to be with someone, given a butterfly wing flap change in your past, you could be with someone else.
So why did the man with the crazy hair and the eyeliner, who's an atheist, decide to get married? That seems very conventional.
I don't think I ever was thinking of not getting married. I come from a family with parents who are still married, and Sarah comes from a family with parents who are still married, and all the evidence points to the idea that my happiness and security and sense of belonging and confidence and all those things come from my family, and I wanted that, you know. It would be absurd of me to turn my back on an idea that worked for me.
Useful that she knew you before you had the fame?
Yeah, useful for so many reasons. Useful for me and my sanity and making good choices in my life. Useful for us as a relationship because we were locked in. To sort of go back to your original question about marriage, I'm absolutely conservative of lifestyle. I don't think I'm intellectually conservative or socially conservative. I'm quite politically conservative, I guess. I'm a pragmatist. I don't take drugs. I like jogging. I've been mostly with one girl since I lost my virginity. I like my family. I don't swear in front of kids or name my children pizza. You know, I'm quite boring.
We'd better cut to some music then, given that people will be bored to tears by what you're saying. Tell me about what are we going to hear next, Tim?
Well, I couldn't do a list without a Beatles song, but I just found this so ridiculously hard. To my surprise, I thought I would choose a McCartney song, but I chose a John Lennon song because it's just so cool.
That was the Beatles and I Want You, She's So Heavy. So, Tim Minchin, it seems very unfair to continually quote your own work back at you, but it's a great place to start with so many questions. You once said, I hope you remember this, I have one life and it's short and unimportant. Do you feel that you're sort of just here for a moment and gone and that'll be that?
It's not so much that I feel that as I know it. Our obsession with surviving our own deaths, as Dawkins says, is... I mean, the very idea that it might not be the case just reeks so much of fantasy that it must be wrong.
But how we, well, not how we, but how people like you live on is you live on in your art. You create stuff. For example, if you, you know, if you, I'm thinking of Lionel Bart, I'm thinking of Oliver, I'm thinking of the fact that in 1960 it made it onto the West End stage, and if you walk through the West End tonight, you can buy a ticket and see that same hit show. There is a legacy there, a feeling that I have left something that is substantive and will tell people a little bit about who I am.
It's a lovely thought, and there's no doubt when people you love die, you take comfort in remembering the things they did, whether they're just, you know, making good porridge or whatever, you know, whatever it is, whatever small things you will remember about them. And to the extent that we are remembered, we can live for as long as those memories last in people's minds. But it's sort of not of interest to me,
right.
My legacy. Even if you do live in the memories of a couple of generations, it's so fleeting that it's insignificant. But none of this is depressing. In fact, it's awe-inspiringly awesome that this event has happened, one's own existence. The idea that after all this space, there's you, and then there's not you, and you are faced with the question of how you're going to spend that time. It's so much more profound than any hypothesis about some pathetic garden with unicorns and hugs that goes forever. I mean, people don't even know how to spend their Saturday afternoons. What do I want with eternity, you know?
Casper and Violet, then, where are you with them on the Tooth Fairy?
Well, I haven't lost any teeth yet, so I'm putting that one off.
But do you allow a little bit of magical non-realism to creep into to childhood fantasy?
Yeah, I hope they find their own ideas. Violet's incredibly inquisitive, and she keeps asking me if Santa Claus is really real.
What do you say?
Well, I can tell her that Santa Claus is coming because it feels like telling a story. But if she looked me in the eye and said, "Is Santa Claus real?" I couldn't lie to her, so I said, "Well, he's real in the imaginary world."
I'm going to take you away from all these worldly concerns, of course, and dump you on an island.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yay.
How will you be on the island?
I don't know. I don't suppose I'd do very well on my own. I'm quite social, I think. Part of having a brain wired like mine is hypotheticals, like being on a desert island. I just start asking. I want to ask questions about logistics, you know.
You'll not find any answers from me, I'm afraid.
No.
You can tell us, though, what your final choice is going to be for the day. Tim, what are we going to hear?
This song, my brother and I used to play it in pubs, and it's just such a great pop song, incredibly uplifting. And I guess it's a great love song, too. And it's Swedish.
Always when we fight, I kiss you once or twice, and everything's forgotten. I know you hate that. I love you, Sunday sun. The week's not yet begun, and everything is quiet, and it's always.
That was The One Who Dies, a You and Me song. So, Tim, we come to the point now where I give you the complete works of Shakespeare, and I usually give people the Bible. Do you want to take the Bible?
Oh, I think I could probably. It's a bit dangerous for me taking the Bible because I fall asleep reading books and they often fall on my face.
Wouldn't that be the final irony?
Yeah, if I got killed by the Bible. And it's incredibly soporific because it's so dull. So I'd almost definitely do me an injury of some sort. I guess the Bible's an interesting enough work, but I'd rather take something else. But
I'll take something else, but you can take the Bible as well as something
else. Okay, sure, I'll have a Bible. I'd take out the violent bits. I could use it for fire paper for months.
The choice is yours. And also you get to take a book that you want to take. What would you like to take?
I think it's Vonnegut.
Okay.
Slaughterhouse Five.
Okay, that's yours. You're allowed a luxury as well to take to this island.
Yeah.
You sound skeptical.
I assume lots of people say robotic sex doll.
Probably. Yeah, but we've probably had at least 50 of those.
Yeah, but if it wasn't something to occupy me in that way, I'd have to take my piano. Is that all right? Can I take a piano?
You can take either of those.
It'd have to be
things.
Self-tuning. Would I take? That's a good question. Would I take a piano over a robotic sex doll?
Well, would you?
Probably not.
The robotic sex doll is yours then, Tim Minchin. And if you had to choose just one of these eight to save from the waves, which one would you save?
I'm going to go with Waterloo Sunset.
Tim Minchin, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. What an honour.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.